Welcome to the Unsuccess Podcast, a podcast where we talk about faith and ministry here in Portland, Oregon. I'm David Libby.
I'm Josh Hawk.
And today we've got Nathan, the elder pastor at Red Sea Church.
Nathan the elder.
Something like that.
Nathan
like
the elder.
The prophet.
Yeah, right.
The elder.
Well, welcome. Thanks for being on.
Absolutely. Yeah, my pleasure.
Tell us kind of your story. You've been a church planter for some time and then came into the space. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. You want me to start at conception, or how far back are we going?
Before conception, teach us about like the history of the world and then why it changed when you...
How did the conception part happen?
You see, Josh, when a mommy and a daddy love each other very much. I found myself kind of falling into ministry. It wasn't really on my radar, but I grew up about an hour and a half south of the Portland metro, so the town of Albany. Albany, Corvallis were kind of my stomping grounds.
Nice.
And, public school kid, did pretty well in school, grew up in a Christian family, wound up being a very broken Christian family, but... I graduated from high school with a full ride scholarship to the engineering college at Oregon State University. And I got about a year into that program and realized I don't think this is it for me. I don't think this is the call. So long story short, I wound up surrendering that scholarship and moved overseas and spent the next 4 years as a missionary in Germany. Germany was like the base of operations, but from Germany kind of traveled all over the world, really.
How'd you get connected with that?
Yeah. So I was working with the organization Youth with a Mission, if you're familiar, YWAM.
Yeah.
I didn't even know about YWAM, but I have a brother-in-law who's also a pastor up in the Seattle area who is a mentor of mine. He was also my wife's youth pastor when she was growing up. And he had kind of done sort of a gap year program when he was done with high school and had spent, a couple of years in Australia with YWAM. And so I kind of came to him for some advice as I was kind of a little bit of a wreck, wondering, like, what am I supposed to do with my life? And he was like, hey, what would you think about taking a year off, kind of give a year to God, see the world, grow in your faith, whatever? And I thought that sounded pretty cool. So he was like, hey, YWAM's a good option. And I thought Australia sounded pretty cool. That didn't work out. And I was like, how about Mexico? That didn't work out. About the last place I ever wanted to go was Southern Germany in January. By kind of some freak circumstances, that's where I wound up. And, within probably about 6 weeks of starting my time in YWAM, I realized this is not just going to be a 6 month school for me. Like this is going to be a longer term deal. So my wife and I got married. We stayed there together for, almost 4 years. And it was a wonderful time of growing in our faith and kind of being exposed to Christian missions around the world. It was very kind of niche in that it was very much a parachurch, foreign missions, kind of focus on short-term missions work. That was really successful at aiming toward the goal of making converts. I would question how effective we were at making disciples, which I think is a longer term game, if you will, right? I think that's kind of the sweet spot of the local church actually is long-term investment in the lives of actual people that you're living in and among. So we would parachute into Northern India and be there for 6 weeks to 3 months and do some cool street outreach or whatever else, feed some kids, hang out in orphanages. But then we would peace out. And I remember kind of having this existential crisis is maybe too strong a word, but just kind of like, what am I, are we wasting our time? Mm. Like when we leave, we're not leaving a church here for these people to.
Okay. So when you say parachurch, you're not like partnering and helping people connect.
We would when it was possible, we would try, but by parachurch, I just mean like a Christian organization, ministry organization that is not a local church, but is hoping to come alongside the local church and be supportive. And when possible, we would, but it wasn't a mandate for what we were doing. So So we did cool stuff. Like I drove a big, huge box truck full of like, I don't know, 200,000 toys and stuffed animals and stuff into like northern Romania, in this like little gypsy village outside of Transylvania.
Wow.
We didn't see any vampires, unfortunately, but like got to do cool stuff like that, like go into these insanely impoverished places and bless people with all sorts of cool resources and give kids toys. And, you know, and sometimes we would do like a little Bible lesson or a vacation Bible school kind of camp, that sort of thing. But anyway, so we spent like 4 years doing this, and it was during that time when I feel that both kind of through my processing of scripture, but also just kind of through my experience, I started to realize that I think we were missing the mark in terms of, at least in terms of like the Great Commission that we were given, right? Therefore, go and make disciples of all nations and baptize them, teach them to obey all that I've commanded you. Like, and I started to realize, man, I really see some beauty in the work of the local church when it comes to carrying that out, long-term investment in cultures and cities and people. And it was about that same time that my brother-in-law sent me a book, and I was reading it, and it was from, I won't name drop, but it was from it's kind of the modern church planting movement, and it was a church planter who was experiencing quite a bit of kind of success or fruit in ministry. And I read it and just, man, my jaw dropped. Like I literally had no idea that people were still church planting. I thought that every church in existence was like the conservative Baptist church that I grew up in that was 100 years old.
And what year was this?
This would have been like 2006 probably.
Okay.
That I'm reading this. So, I was like, people can just start new churches? Are you kidding? Like, that's allowed? Like, how do we do that? And so I started praying and really began to feel kind of this conviction, I think, from the Holy Spirit of, like, this is the work that I've called you to. So we finished up our time in Germany and, felt God calling us back to the Pacific Northwest. My oldest, so I'm a father of four, my oldest was born while we were still over there. And then we moved back in December of 2007 with kind of this nebulous vision or goal to like be involved in church planting. The problem was I didn't know the first thing about pastoring, let alone church planting. I mean, I'd been involved in a church when I was a kid growing up, but you know, kind of divorced from it other than that. So we moved home to the Northwest. We actually moved into a townhouse with some family members in Corvallis, and we're just praying like, God, how do we go about starting a church? And we knew that if we wanted to start one, we probably ought to be a part of one. And so that first Sunday that we were back in the States, we were kind of Googling and looking for churches and whatever, and we're walking around downtown Corvallis, and we hear this worship music coming out of this, like, underground nightclub. And we're like, what is this? It was called Platinum, the Platinum Nightclub. And so we wander down the stairs, and sure enough, there's this church plant that's meeting down there. They were, like, maybe 6 months in. They'd launched, you know, a couple of quarters before. And I sat through the service and was really thrilled with what we were seeing. And so I went up to the pastor after the service, and I was like, hey, I don't think we've ever met, but I'm kind of coming straight off the mission field. I'm a little burned out and exhausted, but also I feel like God wants me to be a church planter. I don't know the first thing about how to do that. And he was like, can I buy you a beer and we can talk about it? I was like, this is going to work. This is going to work out. So that started a fast friendship. I spent the next, I guess, maybe 4 or 5 years at that church, serving in different capacities. I was working for Apple at the time, selling iPods and MacBooks to kids on Oregon State's campus, and kind of working towards this goal of ministry. And eventually a staff position came open at that church, so they brought me on as the worship leader. I'd grown up around music and had done quite a bit of worship leading growing up, and so that made sense. Although the calling was church planter, they were like, if you can come in and lead worship, we can free up some more of your time to work on development. They helped to put me through kind of a seminary program that our association of churches had started, and gave me a lot of time and freedom to begin to think and pray about where are we going to plant a church? What's that going to look like? And then eventually in 2014, they sent us out. They launched us. And so we moved next door to my hometown, Albany, which is, if you're familiar, mm-hmm. really just the other side of the Willamette River from Corvallis. And we launched a church that's called Hub City Church almost a decade ago now. And it was a wild ride. So
how so?
oh, man. I have maybe hundreds of friends that are church planters that I've, or at least acquaintances that I've met in different networks and over the years being a part of different associations.
Church planters seem to find each other.
Kind of, yeah.
And I imagine that's out of a, like, church planting is its own little foxhole.
Yes.
Like, ministry has, you're basically in a foxhole, but I think church planting, as opposed to, like, Josh and I started a new church, but they, from two established churches, right. like, what you were doing is a completely different thing.
It is a weird thing. Yeah, we are gluttons for punishment, I think. And I don't know, maybe a church planner is like a pastor. It's just like a really dysfunctional one that yeah. wants to take ridiculous risks. But yeah, so to answer your question, I think maybe to a person, every church planter that I've ever talked about, when I tell them the story of our first year planting Hub City Church, they sort of unanimously across the board say, that is the worst story I've ever heard. Like, that is the worst church planting story ever. And it was just so full of trauma and crazy. So I can give you probably the 30-second version of the story. But when I think of our first year planting, there were four. There were like four big major events or hurdles or milestones or whatever you want to call them that we faced that I thought would kill us, would derail us, would end the thing. But every single one of them, in by God's grace and sovereignty, I think just he used it to actually grow the church in both health but also in size and momentum. And so it started with what was going to be our launch Sunday, which is like a big deal in church planting world. Like you're building up to this thing for like a year, you know, and maybe you have some preview services and you're getting everybody to invite everybody. And we had a leadership team of three. It was me, it was my associate pastor, and then a children's ministry director who was also my best friend. Working towards the launch date's on the calendar. And this friend of mine, Sam, on his 28th birthday, which was about 6 weeks after his second child was born, on his 28th birthday, 6 months before our launch, he got diagnosed with stage 4 cancer, which wrecked us. What further made it difficult is that he wound up passing away like a week and a half before our launch service. And so we had to pivot last minute. And instead of having our launch service, we had his funeral service that day. So literally day one, we lost 1/3 of our leadership team. You know, one of our staff members, elders, dies at 28 years old. And I had to officiate his funeral. It's the first funeral I've ever done in my life. And not only is that institutionally devastating to a church plant that's desperate for leadership and qualified people, personally, it was
This is gutting. This is a friend.
Yep. One of my dearest and very best friends. So that was terrible. But we pivoted and we launched the church the next week instead. And what was crazy, I mean, Sam's funeral, there were probably 500 or 600 people that came to his funeral. And then a whole bunch of those, and he had a pretty radical, cool story of like coming to faith in Christ, and it happened for him later in life. So most of the people that he grew up with, family members and whoever, were not like church people at all. They came to his funeral, and I got to talk with Sam in hospice before he passed. Like, what do you want me to say? What do you want me to do? And he's like, I just want you to preach the gospel and tell these people why and how I found hope in Jesus. And so I did, and the result is, as we launch our church the next Sunday, bunch of these people that had come to his funeral that had nothing to do with church show up at church. And they're like, well, Sam wanted to be a part of this thing. and that message that you were sharing was really meaningful. So that was one. Second hurdle was we had searched for over a year to find a location. There was nothing available, nothing that we could rent. And then kind of last minute, we find this old abandoned grocery store, and it was kind of devastating. It would be like if a church today moved into the Dollar Tree right over here, right? Mm-hmm. Like, we'd be like, I guess over here. You'd be like, man, there's like windows missing. There's probably animals like nesting inside. Like, it was kind of that sort of situation. We didn't have any money, but we had a decent number of people who were willing to work. So we spent like 3 months cleaning up this grocery store. It was huge. We like hung these curtains up in the middle of it to make like this little tabernacle kind of thing. So, you know, it wouldn't feel like this cavernous, wasteful space. Anyway, we get in, and we've got church in a grocery store. And it was quirky and weird, but we kind of loved it. And we were there for 3 months, and then the landlord came to us and was like, I am so sorry, but a big local big box store has seen all the work that you guys did to fix this place up. And they just came in and offered me 10 times what you guys are paying me in rent. So I gotta boot you guys. You gotta move out.
So the big box store took what you did, yes, and were like, hey, now this is nice. Yes. So screw those people. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. So we got booted. The tricky thing about it is it was 1 month before Easter. And there was nowhere else in the city that we could meet. And so we were like, well, I guess we can't meet. Like, maybe, I don't know if we're a church then at that point. Like, I wind up getting, so I'm panicked. Like, I guess we're done. I get a phone call from a principal who I had never met at one of the local high schools. And turns out he's a believer. And he's like, I hear you're looking for a space. He's like, I've been the principal here for a decade. And for a decade, I've been praying that we could welcome, like, the presence of Jesus to this campus and that a church would meet here. Would you guys be willing to? And I was like, absolutely we would. We have no other option. So we move into this high school cafeteria. They even have storage on site. Like, we could store all of our stuff. And
oh, no way.
So we move in. So we don't have to do, like, the truck and trailer mobile church thing, which is brilliant. We move in. Our first Sunday, there's Palm Sunday, 1 week before Easter. And then Wednesday, between Palm Sunday and Easter Sunday, an arsonist lit the building on fire, and it burned to the ground with literally everything we owned inside it. I mean, literally everything the church had and procured, from our laptop to projectors to chairs, all of our children's ministry material to the brand new drum set I had bought the week before, and the keyboard and guitar amps, like everything, total loss, completely destroyed. 4 days before Easter.
This might be the most wild church story I've ever heard. I don't know about you, Josh. This is in the top three at least.
Yeah, it was bizarre. And again, I was like, well, we've lost everything now. So again, I guess so cancer, and then a building eviction, and then a fire. We were like, what are we? Did we hear wrong? Are we cursed? Or like, what is? And so I went to our elders and I was like, I think we're done. And they were like, no, we're not. Like, we're gonna have our Easter service. We're gonna do it right beside this burned down building. If you want to talk about like a visceral experience of Holy Week,
I was gonna say
devastation of Friday.
You talk about death and resurrection.
Yes,
like,
absolutely. So we push ahead. We go ahead and do our Easter service. What was crazy is K2 News from up here in Portland came down, videotaped, unbeknownst to us. We didn't know. They just showed up on the site. We heard this story about this new church, and it's Easter Sunday, and videotaped the whole service. And I swear, it must have been somebody who loved Jesus who was in the editing room, because they pushed the story on the news that night. And it was like maybe a 10-minute clip sharing the story, but like, they shared me preaching the gospel, like Christ crucified and resurrected. They showed people getting baptized. They showed us in worship, like, and beautifully shared this story. So that goes out over the news to, I don't know, a couple million viewers, I would assume. And then I start getting emails the next morning from people literally all over the world. Like, I got emails from people in England, from people in Africa, from people in India, and all over the United States, including some pastors that I had never met but really respected. A guy, you guys know John Tyson, in New York? Yeah, Tyson emails me.
Dang.
And
all from a local news story, not even like,
yeah,
this isn't.
Yeah. And it's partly because some of the funding that I received to church plant came from the PCA, Presbyterian.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And
they shot out.
And Tyson is part of that same sort of association. So they shot out a little email to their group, and our local church association shot out emails and whatever. And people are just like, what do you need? We got you. And so just like packages from musician's friend and whatever start showing up at my house. And not only did they make us whole, we got everything that we had lost back, but better. And then all these people start showing up. Because they're like, we heard this story on the news. This is traumatic and devastating and crazy. This is a church that needs a lot of help. Maybe we could show up and be helpful. So the church probably grew by threefold overnight because we lost everything in a fire, which was crazy. And then the fourth, maybe I won't get into it too much, but the fourth tough one was just, it was your classic story of a member of the congregation whose hidden life of destructive sin had massive, massive ramifications for the entire church. And yeah, so we had a member who was arrested by the FBI in a prostitution sting that blew up like crazy, and that was just kind of the surface of a lot of the sin. Wound up in a divorce, and the church as leaders kind of having to pick sides, and we chose the most vulnerable, which meant the wife and children that were involved. And it was one of the only times, I think, in my ministry, hopefully this doesn't mess up the sound too much, this is slowly sinking into my lap, it was maybe the only time in my my experience of ministry where, like, going through the steps of church discipline actually resulted in the expulsion of a church member. But we finally had to say, bro, we love you. We want the best for you. We've attempted reconciliation. We've attempted to walk towards repentance and holiness. And there was just no willingness to walk on that journey with us. So we actually had to uninvite that person from fellowship, however you want to say that. And the result of that was about a third of the church left because we weren't showing grace, because we weren't showing mercy, because we kicked this person out. And it was actually a safety concern for the others involved. So, and once again, a very dear friend of mine, a person who had been instrumentally helpful, making us whole after the fire, had been really involved kind of in church leadership. I would say maybe kind of like a deacon-level church leader, running our sound and tech ministry and that sort of stuff. So it's a person for whom I'm still deeply care about and love, but you know, we had to make a hard call. So, and I had never done that before either. And I was doing all of this as a 28-year-old. So, yeah, that was our first year. And it sucked.
It's super fascinating. I think I want to like fast track now because I mean we could talk then like your stint in Bend and then how you like you moved here then too in Portland. But one of the things that I'm super fascinated about that story, you know, like you share that and it's like yeah, there's four big things that should have closed you down. Instead, it had like the inverse, you know, maybe except the fourth. But to see the church overcome these hurdles and obstacles is to say, wow, God must truly be in there. And that becomes the story that you share. That becomes like the Tim Keller story of like, hey, I planted this church and boom, now it grows. You're not there anymore.
Right.
And so as I think about, you know, like what David and I have been trying to do with this show is to try to like, I don't know, expose some of that. Like, didn't you, you had this mountaintop experience. You like fell into this. You never planted a church before and now you did. And now like, here's this relatively successful church. Yeah. How has that been, you know, in the next couple of steps, you know, and where you're landing now? I have a sense that, you know, like some of it is that, and I think going back to that evangelism versus discipleship kind of piece, And so, like, what's that been like? How have you, what are some of the things that you've had to let go and journey through, just kind of emotionally and spiritually through that?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's been hard. It's been good. I would have loved to never leave Hub City Church. But I think my own inability to deal with the trauma of that first year, and just like the like frenetic pace that church planters tend to run at. It's like the difference between like a church planter and kind of your typical established church pastor is you wear every single hat. You know, you wear your preacher hat and your counselor hat and your worship leader hat and your networking hat and your fundraising hat and your entrepreneurial hat and all of these things you're doing all of the time. And there was like I was probably averaging 60 to 70 hours a week that I was working for this church and working on the building once we finally sort of got a more permanent space downtown. Like I just never took a break. And in never taking a break, I never got the chance to, I think, process my own hurts and wounds and disappointments and everything else. And so long story short is I wound up burning out at year four and went to our elders and was like, I can give you 2 months. I'll give you two more months of work. And then I'm going to go either, I told my wife, I was like, I'm either going to build houses for a living or I'm going to become a long haul trucker. Or I was like, don't have to talk to anybody. and God had other plans again, but I love Hub City Church. I'm thrilled. They're still in existence. They're still doing well. The leadership has all transitioned more or less since I was there. At least the eldering body has. They have some new pastors and staff. They have one OG staff member that was my hire that took over for Sam after he died. It came in and was our children's ministry
See,
director.
Nathan says OG. We just, in our last episode, we talked about, I got called out for saying OG by my 9-year-old.
Oh.
She's like, Dad, we don't say OG anymore. And she said, that's cringe, Dad.
Yeah. Oh, man. That's probably the least cringy thing that I'm going to say. So. Yeah.
you should do like me and go way in the past. I say rad all the time.
Yeah,
and
that
I think,
works.
I think if you go far enough back, it works. Like it becomes cool again.
Yeah. I agree. Yeah. Yeah, so, you know, like being at Red Sea Church now, which I think in terms of kind of philosophy of ministry and even just sort of like doctrinally, theologically, like we're pretty in pretty close alignment with where we were at in Hub City. But like the feel of the church is very different. We are a very, very small little kind of neighborhood church. You guys get pretty much every church in North Portland is that. Whereas I think when I left Hub City Church in Albany, you know, we were pushing, probably 300 plus people pretty regularly. And it was kind of on this upward trajectory of, I think that for my first year or so here in North Portland, I kind of lived with this fear that like, are my best and most fruitful days of ministry behind me? Yeah. You know, did I peak at 30 years old and now everything's just going to be this kind of like downhill slump into
mediocrity.
Irrelevance. Yeah, irrelevance, mediocrity, whatever. That was my fear. I don't think it is any longer. And I think it's because God has changed in my own heart the metrics by which I view success and the things that I value in ministry. And I think the work that we're doing at Red Sea is probably, I would say especially to other pastors, church planters, other, or even the general public's kind of idea about what makes a successful church. It's probably very unsexy, very uncool, but I am honestly finding more meaning and life and joy in the work here now in this neighborhood than I've ever found in ministry. It's also the least successful. Maybe I'm a great example of your title here, like the Unsuccess Podcast. Like nobody would look at Red Sea from
the
outside.
You definitely rival us for that.
Yeah, okay. We can arm wrestle for it. I'll arm wrestle you, David. I don't want to.
Yeah, I'm a pretty easy arm wrestle.
Yeah. So we're here, and we've been here now for 3.5 years, and absolutely love it. Regularly, my wife and I talk about how we feel more at home in North Portland than we've ever felt in our lives. Mm. And there is something about the grittiness and brokenness and beauty of this context that really grips us, and we love. And that is like coming here after a 2-year stint living in Bend, mm-hmm. which is, I don't know, you guys, I'm sure, have maybe spent time there before, but Bend is like one of the wealthiest per capita cities. It's the whitest city in the Pacific Northwest. It is like this utopia of mostly Southern California, Californians now, that they built in the desert, this oasis of like,
yeah,
joy and lack of poverty and crime and cleanliness. It's just this interesting little bubble. People that live in Bend will literally refer to it as the bubble. And I think Bend is wonderful. We love to vacation in Bend. It was a misfire for us contextually. I don't think we were ever suited to live there long term. But in our conversations about coming to North Portland, a little bit of it was, is this a culture in which we want to raise our children? Mm-hmm. And we both kind of wholeheartedly said, no, I don't think it's for us.
When you're referring to Bend?
Yes. Yeah. Yep. Yeah. So the draw to North Portland, knowing in a very small measure what we were kind of getting into, something that we understand now much more fully, was the draw of like, hey, we're going to move to St. John's. We're going to have our kids in public school here where our kids will actually be the minority. Something that they have certainly never experienced. And we're going to be surrounded by real significant crime and addiction and abuse and violence, gun violence, endemic in the neighborhood. Yeah. That was, rather than scaring us off, that was, I think, kind of the draw, mm-hmm. of like, I don't know what I'm allowed and not allowed to say on this podcast, but I remember one of my early conversations with sort of my predecessor at Red Sea, who's one of my best friends, Josh Duncan, who you both knew pretty well.
We used to bleep cuss words, and then yeah. I think I used enough that Josh just got sick of it. So you can say whatever yeah. you want.
He described, he said that it was kind of like an unofficial motto that he had adopted and held on to for a while, but he said, and this is coming from a sincere place of love for North Portland, but he described it as like just the right amount of shitty.
That's so good.
And I got a kick out of that and I've certainly experienced some of it. So
I think you used the word grit, and I feel like that's maybe the best description of what this is. We talked with Daryl Grenz before and kept it really to what this space is. And I would say this is true of churches here, and I'd say it's just true of the area that it's not like a hometown pride because of hometown pride. I think it's a people love and care about this space, and even with its issues like gun violence. I mean, I live in low-income housing here, and there are shootings on occasion. Yeah. Derek, our youth pastor, jokes that the game here is firework or gunshot, which is more true than you want. I think there's this care and this determination that people have here. You're wearing a Roosevelt hat. I think people get excited about our schools because, you know, we don't just get handed money from the city to, like, build new things. I mean, there was a reason people freaked out about the new expansion at Roosevelt, because that just doesn't happen. And so I think there's a determination here, a grit here. And I think we can talk about how that's true in the churches in the area. I'm sure that's true at Red Sea. Just a strong grit and a strong, like, we're going to make this happen, and we're going to be Jesus here. Mm. That wasn't really a question. That's just something.
Yeah. So is there a question in there, David?
Nah, I'm a good podcaster.
So the history of Red Sea is probably, it's, you know, similar to, you know, to your church planting, Sean. The founding pastor, elder at Red Sea, you know, like when they started, it was, yeah, a lot of hype, and they had 300 or so, and like started kind of out of our church now, David, or out of this building. And to see that history, and then to see Red Sea kind of come down, and you'd mentioned just last week, you know, that you and one of the elders, like, hey, there's a whole different set of elders now than what we had, you know, when you came on board in 2020.
Yep.
And so there's, yeah. So I'm a little bit, you know, curious about that. This like settling down, maybe the life cycle of a church. And then I'm going to come back to, you've identified yourself, like one of your giftings is an evangelist. You know, how are you showing up now in maybe a more like post-adolescent season of a church? You know, like do you miss, do you find yourself longing for some more of that, you know, running 100 miles an hour? or are you like finding a place to be able to do that, you know, kind of recycling some of the church, or, you know, some of the cycles of the church, or, how are you kind of finding all of that?
Yeah, that's a great question. The life cycle, as I have understood it, of Red Sea, was in 2011 or whatever, when Sean left, the church was kind of at its peak in terms of size. And there's 100 different opinions on if the church was at its peak in terms of like internal health and sustainability, but it was big and there was a sense of momentum. When Sean left, the church basically overnight was cut in half. Now, a handful of people, like dozens of people, literally moved to Southern California with the Garmins to plant a new church down there. Others left because Sean was their pastor. And over the next 8 or 9 years, the remaining elder team just kind of saw this slow, steady attrition, people kind of falling off. Again, my dear friend Josh and I were talking recently about, he and I are both, I don't know if you guys are this way, both of us are pretty deeply affected, even emotionally, like when people leave the church. It's always hard as a pastor. It's hard because you love them.
Yeah.
And especially when you look at these people and like, man, I have spent hundreds of hours worshiping with you, praying with you, sharing meals with you, and now you've ghosted me.
I get kind of upset when I hear, a lot of times is from non-Christians, but I even hear from people in the church that it's pastors get upset because they're losing their tithe. And I'm like, that's not even a little bit true. It's it hurts because it hurts.
Yeah.
So
absolutely.
Yeah. No, I feel you.
Yep. He was saying that for a while he was keeping track of all of these people that he had known and had deep relationship with that had left the church and left relationship with him, and I think he said he had to stop keeping track at 120.
Holy crap!
He had 120 names on this list, and he was like, "I had to stop because my heart was just getting bitter." But over that sort of next, I guess, decade or life cycle of the church, there was a real an intentional move to change the culture from being led by this kind of catalyst figure, gregarious, kind of outgoing. Sean Garman was also very much an evangelist.
Yeah.
And so the next iteration of leaders said, hey, we're going to level the sort of structure of authority. We're no longer pastor led. We're led by elders. Nobody has titles. Nobody has the pastor of title. Yeah. There is no lead pastor here. We are governed by, this plurality of elders, and leaned hard into that, and really leaned hard into turning the focus from attractional model with gifted individual that people come to see and observe to we are family. And really invested deeply in plugging people into meaningful small groups, home communities, whatever, and growing the church as family in deep personal relationship and love and care for one another. They did that incredibly well.
Yeah.
Like the discipleship, the yeah. problem or the weakness there is if you don't have somebody that's kind of maybe prophetic and or evangelistic and gifting and passion, constantly calling the church to turn out and look at culture and engage, you can kind of circle the wagons a little bit. And that's how my predecessor would have described it, is over the last decade, we've circled the wagons and we're doing a really great job of loving and caring for each other as the church. Those that are here love the Lord. They love each other. They've grown deep in their faith. But we have almost entirely lost touch with St. John's. Like, we've lost touch with the culture. We've lost touch with unchurched people. We don't know our neighbors very well. We're not investing in our local schools. We're kind of surviving. In fact, when we got here, when we moved here, there was only one other family at the church that had their children in public school, and it's a woman who's a single mom, right? Everyone else had their kids, and there are plenty of other families with kids, had their kids in private school, Christian school, charter school, whatever, busing them to other schools out of the neighborhood. But there was this very much like, we've got to disconnect from the dysfunction in order to protect our own. And the reason that Josh sought me out to bring me in to be a part of the leadership is that he knew, like, your passions and giftings are so different from my own. You have this desire to reach the unreached and the last and the lost and the least and reach the culture, to live on mission. Like, so God called me off of the foreign missions field to become a church planter. It's still the work of a missionary. Like, I very much am a missionary at heart. That's my calling. I think the vehicle through which I carry that out is pastoring. And I think if you can marry those two together, it can be a really beautiful, space. But he basically said, can you help try to lead this church on mission? Because I don't know how to do it.
I was going to say, you might disagree with this framing, but I think I'm right here. You seem to have, like, the qualities of both previous pastors in a lot of ways. Like, Sean, you mentioned as really an evangelist of pulling people in, which is definitely a lot of your heartbeat. You've definitely got an outreach, evangelism, bring the gospel, while also your pastoral heart seems to have a lot of baked in desire for and push for discipleship. Mm-hmm. And that combo, it sounds like, hasn't been there. It's been one or the other.
Yeah.
And so I feel like Josh was right. I think you, Josh Duncan, not you.
Yeah.
You're never right. had a really good vision of what would be with you here.
Yeah. And if I can speak to it, like, I also very much value a team, a plurality of leaders. It was always kind of my non-compromisable was, I will never be the solo pastor. Mm-hmm. So I could have planted Hub City Church a year before I did, but I didn't have another pastor yet. Mm-hmm. And so I kept pumping the brakes and waiting, like, God, who are you going to bring to the table so I'm not alone? And in every ministry position in the church that I've ever held, I've always been a part of a team. Sometimes that team's just been like two. Sometimes it's been bigger than that. But I never wanted to be the lone ranger. Mm-hmm. In coming to St. John's, my first 2 years that I was here, Josh Duncan and I were both on staff together. And to Josh's credit, he is the best ministry partner I've ever had in my life. Mm. I love him as a friend. He's wonderful. But as a ministry partner, man, it was kind of a brilliant combo. Because in terms of our passions and giftings, we could be no more different to one another. Literally. I mean, we are opposites in that regard. And that made for such a holistic or robust skill set and gifting. We just kind of had each other's backs and knew what was going to work. And yeah, it was amazing. And yeah, then about a year and a half ago, he felt the call to move back home to Mobile, Alabama. So he and Jamie and their girls, Maddie and Nat, moved back home. And that was, to me, to all of us, kind of devastating. Again, institutionally, it probably triggered for me some of the loss of my friend Sam. Thankfully, Josh doesn't have cancer. He didn't die. I can fly to Alabama and see him. We can still talk on the phone. But an unexpected loss in leadership that leaves you feeling kind of lonely, alone. And now I find myself in this spot where we have some other elders. They're wonderful. But I'm the only like full-time vocational staff member, pastor, whatever. And I'm doing the thing that I kind of promised myself I would never do. And yet I believe in it more strongly than I ever have. So I would love for God to bring another kind of ministry partner to the table. I pray for that regularly. But, you know, in the meantime, we're pot committed. That's what I like to say. We are pot committed to North Portland. It has become our family. It has become our community. It is our village. and we are all in. So, yeah. I don't know if I answered your question. I don't even fully remember what it was.
I don't even know if Josh remembers what his own question was.
No, it's still really fascinating because I think in the church world we place such an emphasis on those early years and that, you know, that growing and that evangelist, and you know, like you and I have had lots of conversations where like the evangelist, the apostle evangelist is the sexy pastor, but then we're quick to kick them out of our denominations or associations or even the church, you know, like after year two, you know, you're like, man, there's no space for you, you know, like I want to be comfortable and you're, you know, making me uncomfortable. And, and so there's something that seems to be cool there initially, but I don't know how sustainable that is, you know, over time and beginning to create systems in the church. And so it's, I'll agree with some of your observations, David, about some of the giftings and the skill sets that you have, you know, like, but you still definitely lean more, you know, evangelist and, but wanting to have that team. And but now in maybe, you know, the first time in your life in this like settled place, you know, and some of that could be age too in life, and that's where I'm feeling that way too. You know, I've shared a few different times, but my spiritual director most recently said, Josh, you need to beginning to think 20 years out.
Wow.
You know, this like settledness now, like, man, yeah, I'm not gonna go start a new church, you know, in 3 years time, you know, like, no, this is it. This is, I'm going to see my kids through, you know, through high school and beyond, you know, and beginning to make investments in the community where I'm going to, be, you know, for the remainder of my life. It's this a little bit of a slowing down, but still then having an evangelist or apostle leanings, you know, or giftings.
Yeah.
But in a settled area or in a, you know, in a one place. There wasn't a question in there either.
No, it's a good statement. And I think that, if your nature, if your gifting, if your passion kind of makes you naturally unsettling to those around you.
Yeah.
If you're a person that shakes up the equilibrium, the stability of the church, for example, by coming in and pushing on maybe what might consider sacred cows, or this is how we've always done it, and now you're changing things up. which I think a lot of people would say has been true of me at Red Sea. We've lost a lot of people since I've been there because of some of these things that I'm passionate about that I've kind of pushed for. And all of a sudden people are like, this doesn't feel like my church or this.
Yeah.
We didn't, you know. If you are going to, by nature, be unsettling, pushing people out of comfort zones and whatever, it's really helpful that you are settled while you're doing it. And, you know, that was for us the non-compromisable again. And this is just probably coming from my church planter's bent, was we are buying a house in the neighborhood. We're buying, we're not renting. Like, we're actually going to figure out how to be super house poor and, but actually get something here so that we've got real skin in the game. And it's going to be as close to, you know, down, and which, I don't know if either of you guys have been to my house.
Nope.
Have you not been to my house?
Nope.
I'm sorry about that. We need to remedy it.
No, it's kind of my fault. You told me to come play the Star Wars game you have, and I never.
Yeah, we need to do that still.
I never did. Legion? Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah,
Legion, super fun, or any one of. I know that we're both kind of board game nerds, so we've got to get that. We got to get that going sometime.
Sure.
I'm right. So I'm on Burr Avenue, like right behind. You know where the food truck lot is? There, the beer porch.
Yeah.
So that's where I'm at.
Oh, right.
So I can walk to Red Sea. I do regularly. We're 3 blocks from Roosevelt High School, where my older 2 kids.
I mean, I thought you were going to say you could walk to the beer porch, but
yeah. Sometimes walking home is a little harder. But yeah, no, we do. We walk to the food trucks there all the time and love it. But so I feel like our investment and involvement with the neighborhood is part of what has made us feel so settled. And while I don't have any idea if anybody from Red Sea Church is going to listen to this episode, but they could call me out if I'm wrong. While I think there's still a lot of people at our church that are maybe sometimes feel a little bit uneasy with my leadership or values or things that I push for, or places I've tried to lead the church, I don't think there's a single person at Red Sea that would say that they don't believe that my family is deeply invested in the ministry here, in the neighborhood, in the church. They might not agree with everything that I'm doing and how I'm doing it, but I don't think there is a sense of like, this is a person that's, you know, not actually in it.
It does. Yeah. It gives you some clout, and it gives your people, I would imagine, a sense of like, this guy's not just here to be with us for a bit and then ghost. I mean, you know, we never know what the future holds, but you, like, you aren't just parachuting in, saying hi, giving Jesus a little bit, and then fleeing, which, you know, after Duncan leaving, would losing 2 in a short amount of time would be pretty devastating. So I feel like it gives them some comfort knowing that you're here. You're here for a while. Also, having kids in the high school means you're probably not going anywhere, at least for quite a few years.
Yeah, my youngest is in 6th grade, so she's got, 6 more years before she would graduate.
Right.
And
yeah, so that...
Yeah, if I had a dollar for everybody who said that, I'd probably be rich. But but Nathan is one, like, there's, I don't know, but since... I've met, you know, definitely over this last year, I feel like there's this solidarity, you know, that I find with you, you know, like, and there's this, yeah, this deep connection and brotherhood that, you know, exists. I really appreciate our friendship immensely. And I think some of it is because there is, like, I know you've been here. Yeah. You're coming on to your 4th year, or coming up onto that. But there is this, it feels like you've been here a lot longer, you know, and it also genuinely feels like there's an investment into the community deeply, and you'll be here, you know, for the foreseeable future at least. And so that trust is there. For sure.
I think the other thing that, I found encouraging about you, I think, I don't know that Josh and I would put it in terms of trust issue, but like the ministry leaders have all been really tight here historically. And I remember one of my mentors had said to me when COVID started, he's, you know, in his late 80s, he's been in ministry, you know, since he was in his late teens. So he's seen all of it. And he said near the start of COVID, I think this is going to be the biggest shakeup in the church since I've been alive. And I don't think I believed it then because COVID was, I think at that point we were in the 2 weeks to stop the spread right. time. Like it was early on and he was saying that. And during and since COVID, most of the ministry leaders in the area bolted. And I think Josh and I are still reeling a little bit from it. Josh especially, because you grew up here and there's this idea of why would you ever leave this space? And
I resonate with Josh's list that he had. You know, like I never wrote down a list, but you know, the number of people who have left and
And all that to say, I think you coming in and being like, I'm here, we're here, and that wasn't just for your church. Like, you did not come in and stay hidden in the shadows. There are some pastors that I've met, and they've been like, yeah, I've been here for 6 years. Where? Like, yeah. I've been here for almost 9, and I've never seen you. And so I think I've appreciated that you've been like, cool, we're here. Let's connect. Let's see what this area is. And I feel like that's always been the vibe here. Mm. And I appreciate you being here for that. What do you think, at least, the future looks like for you?
Yeah. I think we're just kind of putting one foot in front of the other and trying to keep doing what we're doing. We keep our connections to North Portland and our relationships here keep deepening, which for me is really life-giving. And it's really interesting, too, because we've kind of found ourselves. So, again, coming in with kind of a bit of a missionary calling, or sense, we've just kind of, I think I had an idea in my mind of what Red Sea Church was probably going to wind up looking like when we were thinking about coming here. And especially with like gentrification and stuff that's been happening in North Portland, like, the fastest growing population here are young white 20 upwardly mobile people, hip progressive Portlanders. And when I look back at my church experience, those were always the folks that were like early adopters and bought into our mission. So like our church in Albany was almost exclusively white, church in Bend almost exclusively like, so I think that I just assumed, and we had a knack, I think my wife and I, for kind of hitting it off with that, those people group tended to be kind of drawn to us. And so I think that my assumption in coming was maybe we'll probably see some success and there will be some growth and whatever else. The irony is like, we've seen almost the exact opposite of that. And we had to stand back a couple years in and say, like, the church is growing. I mean, very slowly, but starting to grow. But as it's growing, it's increasingly reflecting the diversity of really of our public schools too in St. John's, which is fascinating to me. And as we've kind of tried to live on mission, both as what we do in the church world, but also outside of that. I mean, my wife is a midwife. She works for a birth center that's now in Vancouver. And when I'm not pastoring, I am a volunteer football coach in the community. So here I'm repping the hat today. I just spend a lot of my time focusing on Roosevelt and George Middle School and the communities around them. And some of that is because I've coached a couple hundred athletes from those schools now, which is a lot of fun. And we try to, so I don't think that I would say this, I feel the calling of an evangelist. I don't think I'm a gifted evangelist. But the way that we have, I think something that I am gifted at is a gift of both my wife and I is hospitality and leveraging our home and our resources for the sake of kingdom ends, I guess I would say, is really kind of our sweet spot. And so what's been fun for us is finding all this traction with all of these young people and students, which I've got to give my kids credit for. It's like their friends. But it is very, very common that I will come home at the end of the day and walk into my house and there will be 15 kids there. We very regularly, I mean, multiple times a week. We have our own four kids. We've got a fifth kid right now that's living with us and has been since the beginning of the summer. But it's very common that there's 2, 3, 5, 6, more than that, at our dinner table on any given night of the week. And I'm grilling, you know, I really like food, a bit of a foodie. It like kind of crushed my heart when I had to switch to cooking frozen burger patties because there was no way to keep up. Like, I'm not going to hand spank burgers for 20 kids, 10 of whom are football players and are going to eat 3, right? Like, there's no time for this. So I've had to like make this great moral compromise and start cooking pre-frozen like burger patties, but there's no way to keep up with it otherwise, you know?
If they don't watch you grill, you can make your own, like a bomb burger and just
on the
make them shitty burgers.
Yeah,
up.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah, I'm not.
No, I swear this is all the same.
Well, we bought a house. We bought one of like, I think there's only like 3 or 4 houses maybe on the entire peninsula that have in-ground swimming pools. Mm-hmm. So we have a swimming pool in our backyard, which is so funny because my kids were so thrilled when we got the house. The only reason we were able to get that house is because of the swimming pool. It sat on the market forever and nobody would touch it because it's such a liability. It's expensive and, you know, most people don't want them. Man, that has become unofficially like, and I think especially with the Columbia pool closed, it's become kind of the neighborhood pool. So we broke a record this last summer. One day we had 60 kids from the neighborhood in our pool, in our backyard. And over summer break, like that is very, not 60, not every day, but on any given day of the summer, it's probably 20.
Yeah. I live in the apartments right by Pier Park. Mm-hmm. And if you ever see the Pier Park pool in the summer, it's crazy.
Yeah.
Like it's like looking at a piece of, banana that the fruit flies found. Like it's just spotted with kids. So I don't doubt that kids are over all the dang time in your pool.
Yep. Yeah. Which we love. And it's just funny and just such a real place to get to do ministry and make connections and love people. It's probably been 150 or 200 kids from the immediate neighborhood that have spent time in our home at this point, or in our pool or in our backyard, or that have eaten a hot dog or something off my grill. And we love that. Mm. And it's just so funny that like we moved here assuming like we're going to knock it out of the park with like young, married, 20, 30-something adults, and where we've really seen, I think, the spirit of the Lord moving is among students, middle school students, high school students, and we are thrilled.
Yeah.
But it's kind of funny moving here as a church planter and kind of feeling a little bit like a youth pastor.
Right, right. Well, and what's cool, hearing your story, like it's almost as if your kids in some settings are doing like better ministry than you, and you're seeing and learning from what they do. I think at a time, Derek, our youth pastor, would have said like the most effective ministry was coming from one of his youth, a guy named McCain, who helps lead the college group now. Like, McCain just had a realization one day, like, I'm in the schools, like as a high school student,
yeah,
I should like be, you know, bringing my friends into this thing we're doing. And so the youth group ended up being a whole lot of like atheist students, mm-hmm. Many of whom came to Christ. Some didn't, but like Derek, very involved in Roosevelt, but like it was McCain in a lot of ways that was doing that, connecting. And it, when you were sharing your story, I'm like, that sounds so familiar that, it's the students connecting with the students and you're like watching and learning and sort of praising God that like this thing is happening. A lot of it was out of my hands.
Yeah. Yeah.
So cool.
Yeah. It's been super encouraging and super fun. And not just for us. I mean, it's an incredibly life-giving ministry we get to be a part of, but I think really encouraging for our church, who has, I think most of the people that have been around a while have felt for a while, like, when and where is this connection going to happen with our culture, with our whatever? Like, when are we going to see some new faces, new people showing up? And I've told our church this. I've told multiple other friends this, but our Easter service this year, earlier this year, was my favorite church service I've ever attended in my life. And it was one of the smallest Easter services I've probably ever attended. But, you know, for Red Sea, there were more people in the building than we'd had in the building in a decade. And it was the most, without question, the most diverse congregation that Red Sea has ever seen in its history. Because it's people from the neighborhood that were showing up. And we got to celebrate, we got to baptize a handful of people that had come to faith, including four local, you know, kids from our schools here, three high schoolers and a middle schooler. And the community that showed up was kind of their village, so to speak. It's all these teachers and former coaches and single moms who have kind of quasi-adopted these kids that are showing up to support them and love them. And I think it was a kind of a cool moment for the church to step back and see, like, look at what's happening. And that's happening because we're trying to intentionally show up for our community and in these spaces, in these schools, whatever else. Like, my hope and prayer is that that kind of catches fire and clicks for some of our church members to realize, like, showing up in these sort of non-sacred spaces and just being the faithful presence of Jesus can bring about incredible change and transformation. And it doesn't have to be radical. It doesn't have to be insane. Like, I am a volunteer football coach. That's a lot of energy and hours. Not everyone can do that. But everyone could show up and tutor a high school student or could, you know, provide meals to some kids, invite a sports team over to their house. And like, there's just the opportunity is ripe. And I think that stepping into a church that has had felt for several years to be pretty disconnected from St. John's, from the need in St. John's, just didn't see it, wasn't really around it. It's been a great learning experience and eye-opening and encouraging and all of that stuff. So
that's good. That's a theme, you know, the recent episode with Tyler and Marissa, is just showing up, you know, in that relational presence. So thanks for showing up, Nathan. And
yeah, I think you've talked about Red Sea and Roosevelt a whole lot, but I like you and your presence here has meant more to Josh and I than you probably know. Like, for real, it really does weigh on the two of us, like some of the loss that we felt. And you've kind of been a lifeline to us, which, you know, we probably don't point out to people a lot when they impact us. So that's maybe not a great thing on our part, but I so appreciate that you're here and that you're doing what you're doing. So,
well, you guys have been, to reciprocate the compliment, You guys have been a lifeline to me as well. And I think one of our North Portland prayer ministry gatherings, shortly after Josh had left, I came in pretty down and pretty alone and pretty bummed. And I think at, I don't remember which one of your suggestions it was, but we kind of cleared our schedules for the rest of the day, and the three of us went down to Gravy.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
And just ate way too much food and hung out, and
that day was the
got
best.
To enjoy one another's company and friendship.
Every day at Gravy's the best,
man. And so yeah, so I love that, yeah. And I really mean it too. Like I'm a part of a greater association of churches that I have respect for, and I don't have a lot of really deep personal connections there. Uh-huh. The personal connections for me in ministry that have been most life-giving have been coming from these Thursday morning prayer mm-hmm. times. Like I feel yeah. so much more deeply connected with you guys and with Wendell and yeah. with Fidel and with these other local pastors from completely different traditions and denominations. But what we share in common is our common geography and our common mission and our common love for the North. And man, that means a whole lot more to me than somebody on the other side of the city that maybe has a closer doctrinal statement mm-hmm. to what I yeah. would affirm, or maybe doesn't actually. Who knows?
Yeah.
But regardless, I think the fact that we've all got skin in the same game yeah. means a lot.
So. I am Chad at University Park Baptist, who's been here forever, but.
Who told me this week, he's like, hey, I still haven't come on your show yet, so...
Yeah, again...
invite me, dude.
Our bad. Well, Nathan, you pointed out many times, you're like, dude, you haven't dropped an episode in 2 years. Yeah, that's true. He and I, like, probably half of our theological leanings are complete opposites, like... And that happens, but we, like... There's been a kinship there, and there was this just terrible meeting when we announced our like housing plans here. Just 500 angry, screamy people, and the next day, like I was an absolute wreck. And Chad came over to our church and came into me just like. Super depressed on the couch in my office, like couldn't move. And he said, hey, can I just give you a hug? Like that was it. Dude, he'd never lead a worship service with me. It would never happen. And yet, there's this kinship, this connection, and this safety, that I think we all have, maybe because we're in the same foxhole. But I think it's just friendships there yeah. that I've not seen in any other area across, you know, denominational lines or whatever. Yeah. So
dude, Chad is a pastor through and through.
Yeah.
And he is that guy yeah. that will show up and pray for you and give you a hug and love and care for you. And yeah, he's a
yeah, great
he's,
dude.
He's a blessing. He's a great dude.
It's cool. Our podcast is kind of turning out. It's like an anthropology of North Portland.
And it really
that's
is.
What, yeah. Wasn't it Josh that told you when you came in, you're like, yeah. hey, listen to this small hole-in-the-wall podcast. You know, it's like, that'll give you a lay of the land of what...
Yeah.
Well, all our ministries are really niche here, and our podcast is like maybe the most niche of any podcast sure. I've ever seen. Like, I don't even know if there's appeal outside of our area, but there's something fascinating happening in this region of the city, of the country, of the yeah. world that's wholly yeah. unique. And so it really has become something I don't think Josh and I planned on early on, but it's
I
neat,
think
man.
What we got is special, man.
Yeah. It is beautiful. So
it's true.
I think you're special too, David.
I am sorry about the trajectory of the podcast and that the first couple episodes I listened to were like Comer and McKinley and Palau. Yeah. And now you've got Nathan Riley.
No, we sought out.
I apologize.
We specifically sought out Comer and McKinley. We were talking, and those two have long talked about how the church is like separate from everything else and that we don't chase after celebrity. And I'm like, these two are kind of rising stars in Christianity. Maybe McKinley's like on a. on a downward slide in terms of celebrity Christianity, but like it felt like how do you reconcile these things? And so we sought them out to have kind of a tough conversation, and they were both completely game, and I thought had really good things to say there. But it was, as we were talking about unsuccess, I'm like, let's have a couple of, you know, conversations with people who quite frankly have a lot of clout and see what's the thought process there.
Still confusing. Like, John Mark's like, my church is growing by 1,000 people a year and I didn't know what to do. Wow.
I get excited when I see one person I don't know, because I cut my church in half in the time I've been here. So it's interesting. Well, thanks so much for being here. We really appreciate you. Yeah. And for the Unsuccess Podcast, I'm David.
I'm Josh.
And I am slurring my words because my mouth is dry and full, like trying to get full of saliva to be able to talk. So
that's why you're slurring, huh?
Yeah, it's not the wine in your coffee cup.
It's not the wine in my coffee cup. I mix my coffee with some weird things, man.
Where am I going to put the outro music in that?
I don't know. We'll see you next time. Enjoy your day.
Cue the outro music.